I was quite disappointed to find this morning when I went to take the recording from last night and place it on the web that in fact I had failed to turn the recorder on correctly, and therefore I did not manage to record the class. So as a partial substitute for that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to spend 15 or 20 minutes now talking at the microphone and recording, I hope, the essence of the material that we covered at our class last night. We started with a very, very brief treatment of the questions raised in Delchi Carrier versus Rotarex, and particularly the question I had raised at the end of the last class last week, and that was why it was that the CISG had the notion of fundamental breach, and why it was a differentiation of kinds of breach, therefore a fundamental breach and those breaches that are not fundamental. And I wanted to explore that, partially to explore the relationship between it and some parallel notions in Article 2. You recall that the CISG, that Article 25, describes something called fundamental breach. That's a breach which was committed by one of the parties and called fundamental because it results in, quote, such detriment to the other party as substantially to deprive him of what is entitled to expect under the contract. So the party in breach did not foresee, and a reasonable person of the same kind would not have foreseen such a result. In the case itself, the district court had decided that there's a substantial deprivation here, a substantial breach, that obviously the buyer had not received what they reasonably expected to receive, and then any reasonable person would foresee that under the circumstances there would be the kinds of consequences that there was and were in fact in the case, with the need to go out and buy, or we would say to cover, for the breach. The question then becomes, well, why does the CISG differentiate kinds of breach? And I suggested, I think our discussion suggested, that it had at least something to do with the high transactional costs involved in international commerce, particularly the transportation costs, but also other costs like insurance costs, that warrant, in the view of the drafters of the CISG, warrant the continuation of performance obligations on both sides' parts, even if there has been some breach, if the breach is not fundamental. Now, that does not mean that the aggrieved party will not have the right to a remedy measured by what is required as compensation for the losses they suffer by reason of the breach, but it does mean that the contract obligations of both sides continue as they are specified in the contract. You can contrast that with the Uniform Commercial Code Article 2, which, for example, says that if the seller tenders delivery of goods that do not conform in any way to the contract, whether it's a very large way, that is fundamental, quote unquote, or a very small way, the buyer is entitled to simply reject the goods, and at that point, the buyer no longer has any obligations under the contract and can sue the seller for the breach of contract. Now, that's not the buyer's only choice, of course. The buyer could go ahead and accept the goods and then bring an action against the seller for the losses under 2714, the difference between the value of the good as it would have been had warranted and the value of the good as it was as delivered, a number frequently, as we saw, measured by the repair costs to bring the defective product up to the quality that was assured in the contract. So if we have that, why does the CISG require a fundamental breach in order to empower the aggrieved buyer that way? And as I say, I think that the answer has a lot to do with the view in international trade of the importance to be attached to just going ahead and continuing on with the contract insofar as possible, unless the breach is fundamental. And I pointed out that the Uniform Commercial Code itself does depart from this kind of absolutist performance demand in two ways. One is that in installment sales, that a buyer is entitled to reject an installment only if that installment substantially deprives the buyer of what the buyer had expected to receive in that first installment, and that in order for the buyer to declare a breach of the whole contract, the deviations from conformity to contract description have to be so substantial as to deprive the buyer of the, in a significant way, of the benefits of the entire contract. So there you get the idea of substantial breach, and the buyer is, again, as in the case of the CISG, required to go ahead and continue with its obligations under the contract. The seller continues with its obligations under the installment contract until at least there is a point at which there has been a substantial impairment, either a substantial impairment of a particular installment, or even more, a substantial impairment of the entire contract. Another deviation from the UCC's view of the demands for perfect performance on the part of the seller comes in the form of a provision which allows the seller, under certain circumstances, to, quote, cure, unquote, that is, to make good what is bad, deliver more of the appropriate goods required by in conformity to the contract description, repair the ones that have been shipped, ship new ones, but time to make good the commitments that he had undertaken in making the contract to begin with. So that is another approach that relieves the seller somewhat of this duty of perfect performance, which is otherwise a requirement of the Uniform Commercial Code. Unlike the CISG, which, as I say, does say to a buyer, look, the shipment is not exactly what you ordered, but it doesn't fundamentally depart from it. It's not a sufficiently significant deviation so as to deprive you in a substantial way of the benefits of the contract. And so you're going to have to accept those goods, and later on you can sue for a breach. That's a view that's similar to the view that the Uniform Commercial Code takes for installment contracts, but not the view that it takes for more one-shot agreements. Just an interesting bit of comparative law, and it sheds a little insight into the fundamental policy issue and the somewhat different solution in the CISG, but a difference which is probably explained, as I say, by difference in transactional costs in the long distances over which goods are shipped in international commerce in comparison to domestic commerce. We then moved on to the material on the nature of the... sorry. We then turn to our last of our cases involving seller's breach, and a rather interesting one, I think, the KGM Harvesting Company versus Fresh Network case. And here we saw that the problem was that while the seller clearly breached and the buyer clearly covered, the breach was not contested that it was a breach. There was lettuce for sale, and he found the buyer that would offer him more money, and he took it, which of course he shouldn't have. And the buyer, having been deprived of the expected shipment, then went into the market, bought the produce required, that the buyer required, paid more money for it, And of course, under 2712 is entitled to the difference between the cover price and the contract price, just so long as he covered without unreasonable delay and he covered in a reasonable way and he did satisfy both of those tests. The seller's objection to having to pay the buyer that money was that the buyer, in fact, had a cost-plus contract with its buyer, so it was a distributor, and when it passed on the stuff that it bought from this seller, passed that on under a contract of sale to its buyer, the buyer simply paid the additional amount of money. That's what cost-plus means. It's all the costs of the distributor plus the expected profit. So the seller argued the buyer already has his profit, and therefore it's unnecessary to give him the cover cost. He has no loss which corresponds to the damages which he's seeking. The court considered the question. They compared it to a case called Allied Canners, in which arose under 2713, in which the court, in fact, did sustain exactly that kind of argument. Here the court said, first of all, it doubts the validity of Allied Canners. It doesn't think that's the right decision, even under 2713. But it said it's certainly not a decision which binds them in its disposition of a case that arose under 2712. And they say for their purposes under 2712, they believe that the seller is not entitled to a defense based upon what the actual economic experience of the buyer is in the aftermath of the seller's breach. That rather, there's a formula given by statute, and that formula should be followed. And not only is it what the statute said, but the court points out it really actually makes sense. After all, the buyer confronted with the seller's breach, in any case, has a number of strategies that they could follow. And some of those strategies might end up preserving them from any harm that they would have otherwise experienced from the seller's breach. Or some of them may have caused them still less harm, but they have somehow or another avoided some part of the harm, and therefore their actual loss is less than the difference between the cover price and the contract price. This court says it's not really the privilege of the seller here to be able to come to court and say, oh, well, look, he didn't really lose the difference between the contract price and the cover price, because that only benefits the seller, who is, after all, the breaching party. And why should we concern ourselves with the seller in a circumstance in which it's the seller's fault that the buyer had to go out and do whatever the buyer did? In this case, the buyer had to go to its buyer and say, hey, sorry, it's going to cost you more than we thought it was going to cost you, but under cost plus, you have to pay me for it. In another case, it could be, let's say, the buyer going to its buyer and saying, look, we have a fixed price contract, but could you give me an accommodation here because I'm confronted now with the seller who's breached and I've had to buy in the market in a cover contract, and that cover contract was more expensive. And could you somehow or another relieve me of that by increasing the price you'll pay me for the goods that I will deliver to you? Or maybe we could split the difference or whatever other arrangement they make. And the court says, look, that's nice and it's appropriate that the buyer behave that way, but it does not deprive the buyer of the damages that they're entitled to against the seller, because we certainly have no interest in benefiting the seller by giving them the benefit of a buyer that was clever enough to manage a way of reducing its losses. We're going to talk about that issue somewhat more and compare that to the normal rules of mitigation, which we'll talk about in our next class next Monday evening. The only other matter taken up in the class And that was the question of incidental and consequential damages that a buyer can seek against a breaching seller. You may remember that when we looked at the language in 2712 and 2713, they both have the same language that says that in addition to seeking, in the case of 2712, cover damages, or in the case of 2713, market damages, that in addition to those, the buyer can also seek incidental and consequential damages. And we looked at this for a particular reason. If we turn to 2715.2, which is the section on consequential damages, you will notice that one of the conditions that it imposes on the aggrieved buyer is that the aggrieved buyer is not permitted to collect any consequential damages which could have been avoided by making a cover contract. That is, if the consequential losses that he's demanding, loss of profits, for example, is a typical one in a subsequent transaction, if in fact he could have avoided that loss by covering, and covering was available. Of course, there was no obligation to cover, but if he did cover, he would have avoided the consequential damages, and he didn't cover, and so he did have the consequential damages. Well, he's not entitled to get those consequential damages under 2715. And so while facially the statute is neutral on the question of whether the aggrieved buyer covers or doesn't cover, in fact, the provision on consequential damages will frequently make it advisable to cover even if you maybe otherwise did not feel inclined to cover, because if cover is available, at least you may lose the right to you will lose the right to consequential damages if covering would have avoided the consequential damages. And again, when we turn to the material on mitigation, we'll talk about the relationship between that language in 2715 and the core concepts of mitigation as they evolved in the common law and are reflected in some statutory provisions. We then turned our attention to the statute and one case dealing with breach by the buyer. And we see that the Uniform Commercial Code in the present version of Article 2 has an entirely different set of sections of the statute on breaches by the buyer. And we looked at parallelism and differences. Kind of table of contents, if you will, for the damages for the seller against a breaching buyer is 2703. And the two provisions we principally spent some time looking at were 2706 and 2708. In the case of 2706, that's the right of the seller to resell the goods once the buyer has rejected the goods. And it's somewhat longer and more complicated than 2712, primarily because there's a history of sellers engaging in sales that were private and which were not, in fact, for market price, and thus increasing the damages that could be claimed by measuring the difference between the resale price and the contract price. And so 2706 has provisions requiring public sale, or if it's a private sale, requiring notice to the buyer in advance of the private sale. These are ways in which the legislation seeks to avoid anything other than a true resale. Now, the resale is otherwise, however, quite parallel to the buyer's right to cover. The seller's right to resale, again, is a way of looking at expectation and finding it satisfied. The seller has had to go out in the marketplace and take less on a resale than the original contract price, but by giving him the difference between that lower resale price and the original contract price, you do, in fact, put the seller in the economic position that he would have been in had the buyer not breached. And there's a parallelism between 2708.1 and 2713. Both of these measure damages by the difference between the market price and the contract price. Here, of course, the concern of the seller would be a market price that is lower than the original contract price. And 2708.1 says that he's entitled to that difference. We then looked at NERI versus Retail Marine Corporation, and the instance here of, let's assume, and I think the court assumed, that when the seller went to resell and did so pursuant to 2706, he resold the item. In this case, it was a boat. He resold the boat for the same price as the original contracted buy contract price of the original buyer. The original buyer had, in fact, anticipatorily breached. They had repudiated the contract in advance of the delivery of the boat. So the position of the seller was, well, the buyer was, well, look, I breached. But on the other hand, the seller sold the boat for the same price that I was going to pay him, and therefore there are no damages. And the seller argues to the contrary that, yes, there are damages. There are damages because I have lost a sale. And we talked about this is the seller is claiming, that's under 27082, and the seller is claiming the mantle, if you will, of being a lost volume seller. That is a seller who, by reason of this breach, has had reduced by one the number of items that he could have sold, and therefore is entitled to that profit, reflecting the profit he would have made on the item that he would have sold. And I suggested the easiest way to think about it, and I'm sorry I can't diagram this on an audio tape, but I did on the board. The situations you have to imagine are the following. We start out with a drawing in which we assume that there are, in fact, far more buyers than there are items. And I said in class that this can happen in a situation like Rolls-Royce, for example, which limits its number of cars that will export to the United States, and there's always more demand than there is supply. I didn't tell this story, but I can remember at the end of the Second World War, my father had a car that he had been driving around since, I don't know, the mid-1930s, and he had been unable to get a new car, of course, because of the Second World War. And the cars that were started to be produced at the end of the war were far fewer than the demand for cars. And under those circumstances, whenever you get the situation in which there are more potential buyers than there is supply, if you imagine a particular buyer breaching, the seller can simply take that item and sell it to a buyer to whom he otherwise could not have sold because he wouldn't have had the item to sell. And so they are the opposite of lost volume sellers. In that situation, the seller cannot conceivably argue that he's entitled to a lost profit from a lost sale. On the other hand, if you take the opposite situation and imagine that the seller has at hand or available to the seller far more of the items than there are buyers, then when a particular buyer breaches, that is simply a lost sale. That resale is now going to go into the hands of another buyer, but that buyer would have been a new purchaser, and there would have been two sales and two profits. And instead now there's only one sale and one profit because the initial buyer breached and the item, the boat here, was sold to a new buyer who otherwise would have been buying a second boat rather than buying the first boat. So the theory of 27082 is that in the loss volume sale situation, in addition to whatever damages are available under 2706 or 27081, you, the seller, the aggrieved seller, can collect a lost profit from the buyer. There are a variety of problems. Some of them are technical problems. 27082 begins by saying if the damage is under 27081, the quote preceding section, unquote, are insufficient. But it doesn't mention what happens if you resale, if you have a resale of it, and you still claim the damage is now under 2706 are insufficient, arguing that you are a lost volume seller. Nevertheless, courts have read that language to include 706, even though it only clearly refers to 7081. The more serious problem is twofold. Number one, demonstration of the status of lost volume seller. In the Neri case, the court was satisfied that he was a lost volume seller, but I suggested in class that there are some arguments that he was not. The boat was apparently bought out of a catalog. It was not a boat that he ordinarily stocked in the yard, and it was not in the yard at the time of the sale. When the It was resold, but was it resold to a buyer who was just generally a boat buyer who would have come in and bought a boat? If so, then of course he is qualified as a lost volume seller. Or was it a buyer who just noticed this particular boat in the yard and came in to buy that boat? Well, if that's the case, he was not a lost volume seller, because that boat, if you will, was a unique boat and a unique buyer. And there were not two sales of that boat that could have gone on. There was only one sale of that boat that could have gone on. And the court does not examine this question. I mean, it might have been interesting to find out, for example, how many boats this seller ever sold that were not in the yard, or like one of the ones that he was displaying on his lot. Was the buyer who ultimately bought it attracted because he saw the boat in the lot and came in to buy that boat, as opposed to somebody who was just generally interested in buying boats? But the court does not go into those matters, and so we really don't know the answer to any of them. But they're the kinds of questions that you really need to explore and should explore if you're arguing for or against the proposition that a particular seller is a lost volume seller. I hope that this tape serves as a partial compensation on my part for my failure to have the tape of the class, and I can only say that I'll try to do better next time.